Well, good evening and welcome to the May 3rd meeting of the Morro Bay Planning Commission. Let the record note that all commissioners are present and the meeting is called to order. And we will begin our meeting with a moment of silence, please. Thank you. And if you'll rise and join us in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Great. This is time set aside for Planning Commissioner announcements. Are there any announcements this evening? No. Okay. Very good. We're a quiet group. We'll open it up for public comment. This is our general public comment period. Any one of you who would like to come forward and speak to the commission on items which are not on the agenda, please come forward and we'd love to hear from you.
Hi, I'm Jan Paulson. I live at 2690 Nutmeg Avenue. And I don't know if this is the right forum for this, but I won't be able to go to the next city council meeting. And so I just wanted, I was recently at the last meeting on the sewer water reclamation project, and I had some questions, and I wanted to make sure that they got followed up on because they were brought up at that meeting. And that was that all of the different properties that are being looked at besides the Rigetti property are being investigated. There was mention at that meeting that there was another property that I didn't really know too much about that was up Highway 41 on the south side across from where the Rigetti is, and I didn't know if there's status on that one. And there was some more work that was supposed to be done on the Tri-W property, and I was just trying to make sure that whatever the statuses are on those other properties is going to be given to the public. It seems like we got a whole bunch on the Rigetti, but not on anything else.
They just had a meeting prior to ours for the water reclamation facility citizens advisory committee.
I didn't know about that one.
And they discussed all of those things. And then made recommendations out that will be moving forward to city council.
So I didn't know they were having. Was that open meeting?
Yeah,
I didn't know. I never got notice of that one, so I didn't know about that meeting. I knew that there was a 6 o'clock Planning Commission meeting, but I didn't know that there was another meeting. So you can't answer that? Is that what you're saying? No.
I believe the recommendation that came out of it was to look at the Rigetti, or not the Rigetti site, the Tri-W.
But not, now what about the other one on the south side of 41 that's on the same side as the Rigetti as far as...
I believe the recommendation that came out of the committee was to...
Only look at one at a time.
No, they looked at all of them as directed by the city council.
Okay.
And then they went through the Citizens Advisory Committee to make a recommendation on moving on, I think, to City Council.
Okay, so then at the next City Council meeting, they'll just talk about the one? Is that the Tri-W?
They would talk about the whole process and the recommendation that came out of the committee.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay, well, I'm sorry, I missed the other meeting. When did that one start?
It was televised, so
you did that start at 5:30 or 5 or...
Started at 3, it was a long meeting.
Okay, okay.
And it just got out right before we started this.
Yeah, I saw a bunch of people leaving, and I thought, well, what was that meeting? Okay, thank you.
That was it.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, very good. Anyone else that would like to come forward for public comment? Seeing none, we'll close that, bring it back to the commission. Our consent calendar this evening consists of the current and advanced planning processing list and the minutes from our meetings of January 19th and February 2nd. Are there any comments, questions, issues with either of those items? Do we have a motion then to approve the consent calendar?
I'll make a motion to approve A1 and A2 on consent.
Second?
I'll second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. All those in favor of approving the consent calendar, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries 5-0. Moving on to public hearings, our first public hearing is case number B1, which is CP0-404 and UP0-364. I understand there's a recommendation for a continuation on this. Would staff like to comment or?
Unfortunately, when the notice went out, there was an error in it that I wanted, at least one of the notices referenced a city council meeting. And when you have errors like that, it's appropriate to continue the item. And so that is the recommendation. You do have some materials that were distributed right. To me by Commissioner Sadowski. That's those things that are passed out adjacent and that are passed out at the dais for you. And there's copies at the table over there as well if anybody's interested. But yeah, the recommendation is for continuance. We didn't provide you a staff report or a recommendation or resolutions for that reason. And you should also open the public comment period up for this because it was a right. public hearing item.
Right. So this is a public hearing item, and so I will ask if anyone has any ex parte communications to divulge, and if not, we'll open it up for a public hearing. Is there anyone who would like to talk to us on item number B1, 1840 Main Street? Seeing none, we'll close it, bring it back to the commission. Is there a motion to continue this item?
I had shared some information with this with the staff and passed it out to the council, and I would just like to read the opening statement to the packet for the record. Dear Chairperson Dr. Teft and fellow planning commissioners, I'm appealing to this planning commission to put a stay on any proposed project on 1840 Main Street until satisfactory review and resolution is completed by the agencies which I have recently contacted regarding this public health matter. As a citizen of Morro Bay and of California, but more importantly, as appointed community representatives on a planning commission, we have an obligation to hold public health and safety as a pinnacle of our responsibility to the local citizens we represent. We all bring a variety of experience and perspective to the challenges that we face as a political body. It would be disingenuous if we did not voice our concerns, especially when public health and safety are concerned. Our community's health and safety must always supersede any development. Although this matter has been an issue of dissension between some city staff and myself, I believe that after reviewing the attached document, you will find that this matter rises to the level of public health and concern, and that the commission will find this request more than reasonable. As this council knows, I'm a wastewater collection system operator, grade 4. And I had personally reviewed the nitrate study several years ago that the hired consultants of the city did, and I had made comments on that and made my own report and reviewed it. All I'm at liberty to say is that I would appreciate that the council review the information, and then we put a stay on this any development on this project until we get some response from the some of the other agencies.
Thank you. Okay. And the report that you're referring to is the history, the one that says history of sewage contamination. Okay.
This report is the history of sewage contamination of Morro Bay municipal wells. It started 2002 to present.
Mike.
Sorry. This is the report that I'm referring to is a a history of sewage contamination in Morro Bay municipal wells from 2002 to present, and it's dated April 2016. Just for your information, I have been in involved with this issue even going back as far as 2004 when I was working at Cayucas and doing the sewer flow study for them while Wallace Group was doing the sewer flow study for the city at the time. And I think that's enough said.
Yeah, let me just ask staff so we don't get in trouble here. How much discussion can we get into given the error in noticing?
It's a notified public hearing, and the idea is that you just simply can't make a decision this evening because you don't have the material in front of you, and it needs to be continued for that reason.
Okay.
But you can't discuss the item. The
right.
item
okay.
was notified. Was noticed and had the correct dates on it, and the staff reports were, you know, the one-page thing was posted on the website and so forth. So you can speak to it.
Okay, so then we can kind of get into it a little bit. Fine, Joe?
Richard, does your concern about the water quality relate specifically to this property, or is it a general concern about water quality and
No, it relates specifically to this site. This used to be a Shell oil gas station. There was a remediation, MTB remediation action. This site also happens to border a aquifer that's called, referred to the Morro Basin Aquifer, and this particular location has the remediation action is directly related, according to the data that I have put together, to the water quality issue that we find in the Morro Basin. So any development on 1840, I think, is directly related to this issue. And it's gone through a number of agencies, including the Regional Water Quality Control Board, but it's also moved to the state at this time, and that's all. So that's what my concerns are. I'd like to have those vetted before.
Well, now, right. We haven't had a chance to read this report. I just got it
okay.
just now. I don't know. Yeah. It wasn't distributed before by email or anything, was it?
No. Well, okay. I sent it to staff in a PDF form and wanted to be respectful of the Brown Act, so I sent it to staff, and then I wasn't sure if staff was going to send you the PDF and electronic copies, but I did just send it to the staff this morning. And so
So what I would do moving forward would be I would post the information as I would any correspondence that we received in relation to the project on our website.
Right.
So that information would be made available. The things that you don't have are, you know, the environmental documents that go along with this, and the fact that it was routed to the state clearinghouse, and the fact that it may be possible that I can have the city engineer attend the next meeting if that would be helpful, if you think that might be helpful, as he's been involved with this issue for quite a while and is in disagreement with pretty much everything that's written in the report that Commissioner Sadowski provided you.
Well,
as far from a standpoint of it, its impacts to development on that site, anyway, and the regional board also doesn't agree that there's any issue. So there are couple factors written into that. So there are a couple of factors related to that. But I think it might be worthwhile that I speak with the city engineer and maybe have him present for the next meeting, if you can do.
So. Right.
I would highly recommend also that if we are going to have the city engineer here, that maybe we get somebody from county environmental health and the State Department's drinking water director.
County Environmental Health revealed the MND and didn't comment.
Yeah. Yes. Ms. Scott, if I may ask a question about the development on the site, what the remediation was taking place with that, from what I knew, from what I just observed on the site, was all from drilled wells through pumping and reinjection and cleansing on that, and essentially creating a barrier, seawater barrier, and the well remediation. So there wasn't any surface excavation of contaminated soil or surface remediation. So how would the development of the site affect groundwater in a basin that's 50, several hundred feet deep?
It won't, and that's the position of the city.
Okay.
Correction, there was, they had to dig out the U.S. stage, the underground
tanks,
then that lies right on the border. Let me just give you an example of what the city staff and the regional board and the consultants are saying. Basically, they are saying that, and I'm paraphrasing, that our sewage, okay, it's not possible for our sewage to be exfiltrating into the Morro Basin aquifer because the self-sealing properties of the solids. And they're quoting, they've taken a scientific study, American Burgess 2000, that was written for the EPA, and taken a quote and edited it to change the meaning of it. That is one issue that I have. The other issue is that the city in 2009 or 8, when this report was presented, had ruled out sewage as a possible contaminant of nitrates in the Morro Basin aquifer. Since then, it was proven wrong. So now the city's position is that any kind of the sucralose test that was given that proved that there's sewage in the drinking water aquifer, since then the city has said that the contaminants, so any sewage contaminants are coming from the state water delivery supply.
So, Richard, excuse me. If the, just from my information, I'm trying to pick up because I'm, This just landed on my desk too. If the contamination from the shell site was an MTBE contamination, and that was remediated with removal of tanks and then deep water, deep well remediation, how does that affect nitrates? What is the nexus between MTBE and nitrates?
Well, if you recall, back in 1990-something, the MTBE was found at the wastewater treatment plant outfall. That's where they found it. So the MTBE was exfiltrating or infiltrating into our collection system. Now, so that happened. Also, when you look at the report, one of the things that the consultants haven't been able to explain is the nitrate spikes since 2002, right after the remediation action and the state water wells went online. So that hasn't been explained. This is being looked at by other experts. Now, I could tell you that I'm not a geologist, and that was pointed out by the geologist that looked at it, but they're also not fluid dynamicists and wastewater collection system operators. So, you know, we could throw pedigrees around, but it comes down to common sense. We have sewage, we have sewer infrastructure that is entering our drinking water aquifer in that location. And it is all quite close to the 1840 site. And granted that there was 68 monitoring wells that were drilled, that's a fact. So that contributes, but also the sewer lines that are in the vicinity there, particularly the 60-40 line. So that's how it's correlating. If you have exfiltrating sewage and you have your bedding factor, it could channel in, and then it goes in, and especially when the aquifer has been breached because it's on the boundary there.
Well, I guess the piece I'm missing It sounds like we may or may not have issues with the sewer collecting system. I mean, there's some kind of neat photographs in here that I hope aren't too close to my house, but I'm not sure then how that relates to the proposed development. I mean, would that development limit access to repair those lines, or how would the two of those interact?
Based on what occurred on the site, what I would like this commission to entertain is that we put a stay on it so proper investigation can be done on site and all the digging that was going on for that remediation action. It's right on the boundary of the what they call the narrows of the Morro Basin Aquifer Narrows. And based on the data that I analyzed, and I had some help with some colleagues that are a lot smarter in chemistry than I am, I think it rises to the point of public health concern, and it's not. Just to be clear, it's not about a blame game. It's about finding out getting to the bottom of this issue, and we haven't. We're not there yet.
So then, let me ask you this: What? Because I mean, you know a lot more about this than I do. What sort of investigation do you think would be necessary? I mean, would that involve digging up the sewer lines and inspecting them, right, or?
One of the things that we could do is do what the Coastal Commission asked the staff to do back in 2007 when they were looking at the wastewater treatment plant and as an upgrade in its existing location, and that's to fix the lines. Now, you fix all those lines. Because, see, if you have a development and it's obvious that the tie-in, you're going to be tying in a sewer for whatever development into a area that is obviously problematic from a collection standpoint, okay? So I would suggest that let's get all those lines fixed. If we fixed all the lines in the neighboring area there around the narrows and the nitrates drop down and we find out that it's not coming from farming operations like the city staff's consultants mentioned, but it's actually came from sewage, then we will see that, okay? But tying in to infrastructure that we know is problematic, that we know has issues, I look at it as like a public health issue.
Okay. So do we know what the location of the sewer lines this is going to come back. We're going to discuss it again. But one of the things I think, I mean, the question in my mind gets down to specifics. And so the question is, if the lines need to be fixed or if they don't need to be fixed, you know, where are they located? You know, and if something is built on this site, would that impact the ability of the city to do repairs in the future? In other words, do they go underneath where the parking lot's going to be for this drive-in, or
the city's collection facility, its pipes, has been evaluated, and there are areas that need to be replaced. There's a master plan that addresses that, and the idea is that the lines in the areas that need to be replaced would happen as we go through the update and we construct the new wastewater treatment plant. That is on the on the radar moving forward. Now, the city's engineering division has looked at this. We've had numerous conversations about this issue, and it's their opinion that it's completely acceptable to add another connection in this location. That's the bottom line. I've had this conversation numerous times with Rob Leibich, the city engineer. There's no issue.
But I would assume. I mean, don't sewer pipes usually run in under the street? They're not usually running. I mean, sewer mains are not usually running through private property, are they? Or
typically, they're in the right of way. Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess one of the questions I would have coming back to this next time, and we don't need to address it tonight, though, is where are the sewer lines in that part of town, and how you know, would building this project make it any more difficult to get to them?
Regarding the city engineer, the city had put, it's in this report, and I'm going to reference it, but the city had agreed to fix those lines in 2007 in a report that they gave to the public, okay? That was, and they said that they're planning on doing it within a, I think it was within a year. So basically, it was supposed to be done by 2008, 2009. It hasn't happened yet, okay? So here we are. We know we have a problem. The city admitted that they have a problem, that this is a that this is a line that they've already admitted that there is, that needs to be addressed. And knowingly tying in to a dilapidated sewer main is just not good practice, and and especially where this particular property lies and how close it lies to this to our drinking water aquifer, it rises to me to the point where it definitely needs review, or it definitely needs attention. I don't know how else to put it. It's a public health issue. Okay, it's like we have the fact that the city was wrong about saying that the nitrates were. They have a letter to the regional board that said we are. I think the quote was, "We are eliminating the basically even looking at that the nitrates are coming from sewage." They were found wrong 5 years later. It took 5 years to get a test done. Okay, so the credibility of the reports is in question. Okay, and I feel that if reading this packet and sharing that with the staff and this council, I think that you'll find that there's enough cause for pause, kind of, with regards to any development here.
But I would personally basically like to, I mean, I don't know about the rest of you, this is kind of news to me. I mean, this is at this particular report and this information, and I'd just like to get more information. We have the opportunity to do that because we're not going to see this for until 2 weeks from now, but maybe we could get a copy of the report that he's referencing and the issue that where the city was saying they need to be fixed, and just basically get more information so that we can look at this issue when we go forward.
That's fine. I'm happy to sit down with the city engineer and go over. He knows the concerns. Okay, you know, he and Richard have talked about it several times, so it's not an unknown quantity.
Right.
And so I can sit down and talk to him about it and see what he thinks would be helpful to bring forward. I'll go from there.
Yeah. If we want to sit down and talk about what potentially is going to get built here, that's not necessarily an issue. The issue is approving anything until some of these matters are cleared up. Now, we are not going to be making any decisions here. They'll give a time for the council or this commission to review the packet, and all the data in there is verifiable, and has been, like you said, the city engineer is well aware of some of these issues, not only you, but I'll sit there and have a talk with him as well on this one-to-one, no problem.
This issue has been reviewed ad nauseum, believe me. And right. There's a lot of information that goes behind it, and it does date back quite a ways. So there is a history there. So.
Well, maybe we should continue this item to the May 17th meeting.
Yeah, I mean,
a little more information then.
I was just trying to define a little bit what that information would be to me. But to me, it basically what's the most germane is sort of what the impact of the development that we're going to be considering would be on the situation. I think we should recognize that there are a number of options open to us. It's not simply a matter of whether we approve or don't approve this conditional use permit, but we could, in addition, make a recommendation to council that this issue be considered sooner rather than later. Or, you know, we just don't know what the alternatives might be until we look at the information.
Has this issue come up in, say, the last 5 years with respect to other construction proposals, say, within 500 feet? I guess what I'm asking is, if that was the case and someone said, well, it might contribute to this contamination, but not significantly, and now we're, after 5 or 7 years, we're looking at some, Richard, you're arguing that there's some sort of cumulative effect of not just one development.
The city is not doing anything more related to this other than, yes, the pipes, you know, the sewer pipes in the location are on the radar to be replaced. The city, its consultants, and the regional board has said, hey, we're not going to look at this anymore. We've looked at it enough. We think we understand what's going on out there, and we don't think the source of the contamination is the sewer lines. So that's kind of done. So when we sent off an environmental document, the negative declaration, sent it through the clearinghouse and off to the regional board, they were fine. They don't have any issues with it because they have studied this a lot. That's the information that I want to bring forward to you, because you have a report. You have a report that Richard, Commissioner Sadowski wrote, and he's had concerns, and you've heard him, you know, as part of other projects, voice similar concerns. I mean, this is not the first time that he's you know, initiated this conversation. Obviously, I mean, I think all of you've heard it before. So I can at least, in speaking with the city engineer, bring forward the relevant documentation to show where this was at before, what we've done to this point, and why I'm saying what I'm saying to you. I think that's the other side of the argument, is that information. And I'm happy to bring that forward to you, and, you know, we will report specifically on that, not only in the staff report, but in the presentation that we provide to you at the next Planning Commission meeting. And I'll do my best to have, unless you have some kind of conflict, Mr. Leivick present to also speak to it. It's a worthwhile conversation, and the history, I mean, Rob was here through most of it, so it's probably worthwhile for you to hear some of it, okay? And it supports, you know, why I'm telling you what I'm saying, why it's not a concern. I mean, he can bring that forward.
Scott, you know, typically when we do an addition, we require a video of the branch lines. Have these main lines been videoed?
I believe so, yes.
Okay.
There's some pictures of the videos on that packet as well. I appreciate what you're saying, but to be specific, what's different about just a general concern for wastewater collection issues, this is a specific site that was the remediation action site, and this particular action is what is contributing to the variations in nitrogen spikes that occurred since 2002. If you look at it, farming operations haven't changed between 2000 and 2005 to justify the nitrate spikes. So the data is pointing to, well, I'm getting a little bit too detailed as far as that. All I'm saying is that this is a site-specific issue. That's why I brought it up. It's not a general thing that I, you know, I mentioned. Okay,
it's understood. I mean, I've talked about this before. So, I mean,
Okay. Well, I'll make a motion to continue this item to May 17th, 2016, Planning Commission.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any discussion on the motion? Very well, then. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries 5-0. Moving on to item B2, a familiar item.
Boomerang.
Right. This is the case number A00-029 regarding an amendment to the local coastal program and our zoning ordinance. And I believe Whitney's going to tell us about this saga.
So this should be fresh in your minds. This is Ordinance 601 regarding secondary dwelling units and guest house regulations. Let's see what I have on my slides here. So in February, the Planning Commission recommended that City Council adopt some amendments to the zoning ordinance regarding secondary dwelling units and guest houses. And in March, City Council, at its first reading of that ordinance, made a couple of changes, the most important for tonight's discussion being that they removed your recommended prohibition on the use of secondary dwelling units as vacation rentals. But at the second reading of the ordinance, Council basically reconsidered and determined that secondary dwelling units do offer probably one of our best means of providing some kind of affordable housing in Morro Bay. They decided to keep with the Planning Commission's original recommendation that secondary dwelling units should be prohibited from use as vacation rentals, but they wanted to be fair and acknowledge existing permitted secondary dwelling units with active vacation rental licenses. And so they directed staff to come back to you with a grandfather clause, so to speak. So they retained this section that you had recommended, prohibited use as vacation rental. I won't really read through that whole thing. But asked for some kind of exception process to allow those legal units to continue operating as vacation rentals. So with the help of the city attorney, we came up with this exemption clause, which would allow each legal conforming secondary dwelling unit for which the city has issued a valid business tax certificate prior to March 1, 2016, for use of that unit as a vacation rental, aka a vacation rental permit, could continue to be used as a vacation rental provided the business tax certificate has remained valid continuously from that date. If the business tax certificate is not kept valid, said secondary dwelling unit shall no longer be exempt from the prohibition of use as a vacation rental. That is essentially the change here. I believe you were aware of, but just to review, Coastal Commission had a few last-minute comments, and one of them was pretty important, which is to say that in the appeal jurisdiction, both guest houses and secondary dwelling units require what's considered a regular coastal development permit, even though secondary dwelling units don't have to go through the public hearing process. So that change was also made in a few sections regarding permitting. So just to conclude, staff's recommendation is that you forward a recommendation to City Council to approve the added language enabling existing legal secondary dwelling units with an active vacation rental permit to continue operating by adopting Planning Commission Resolution 1416.
Thank you very much. Okay, I will then, this is a public hearing item. I will ask if anyone has ex parte communications to disclose regarding this item. Seeing none, we'll then open this up for public comment. Anyone who'd like to speak on this, please let us hear from you.
Thank you, Betty Winholtz. When I read over the proposed change for grandfathering, I wondered whether this business license can be sold to someone who might buy someone's house, and so it might go on in perpetuity. And I would love to see it, if someone moves, that then the grandfather clause no longer works, that it's ended as well. So I don't know if that's something you would be willing to discuss, because it seems to me this license could go on and on and on if someone sold their house and sold the license to the next homeowner. Whereas if someone moved and sold the house, could it then be terminated as a grandfathered-in piece of property? Is how I would prefer. It seems to me we'd want to phase these out at some in some way. Because it's not what's ideal. It's not the legal thing that we want, which is low-income housing for the rentals. And to somehow, over time, grandfathering in would be eliminated. I hope that makes sense.
Thank you. Thank you, Betty. Anyone else that would like to speak on item B2? Seeing none, we'll close public comment, bring it back to the commission. Maybe you could clear up that question, Scott. Is a business license specific to an individual?
Business licenses are renewed yearly. So it doesn't automatically, wouldn't automatically continue on. The way the ordinance is written now, it's not addressed. So I think if they just maintained that use continually over time, we would allow that use to continue. If it was discontinued, then, of course, as the ordinance says, we wouldn't allow it to continue. If you put additional language in, as Ms. Winholtz suggests, then they wouldn't be able to do it upon change of ownership. So if you're interested in that, we certainly could add that in. I have no objection. The council didn't really speak to that. That wasn't something that came up as part of their discussion or their direction. So I think that is an area where the commission certainly has discretion to make a recommendation if you think that's an issue.
Okay, very well. Scott, do we know how many units would be affected continuing?
I can answer that. Vacation rental permits are, you can apply for that any time of the year. So it's kind of a moving target. It's not like you have a certain number starting in July and ending in June. At this point, we have no more than five. In my last count, I was able to cross-reference three. So it's not a huge number.
And would Airbnb rentals, would they be considered vacation rentals and require a vacation rental permit, or would they just be considered under the TOT and regular business license?
To collect TOT, they would have to have the vacation rental permit, and if it's less than 30 days, technically an Airbnb rental is a vacation rental.
Okay. Let me just mention something. I should have done this on ex parte communication, but I recently had a client and did a permit for a secondary dwelling unit. It didn't involve vacation rental or anything, but I just want to bring that up to the commission. And so should I recuse myself from this issue, Scott, or?
Because you had a client in the past?
Yeah.
Has your permit been approved and you're done?
It's in the process of being approved.
The planning permit has been approved, but you have a building permit application
right.
For the construction of a kitchen.
Which is pending.
The planning permit's been approved.
The appeal period is over.
So no, you don't have a conflict of interest.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure.
As if your permits are final, then it doesn't. Yeah, it doesn't matter.
And
the building
no
permit
connection
thing is
to the vacation rental.
No.
Issue.
Yeah, it's not a vacation rental issue either. So.
Okay, great.
But this is the secondary dwelling unit ordinance, so I can see why you would ask the question. I mean,
right.
Makes sense.
Any other questions for staff? Yeah, Joe. Go ahead. We're there.
Because there's only three or five of these units, and I agree with the member of the public, would be a good idea to eventually phase these out in fairness to all the other people who have these secondary dwellings. But I am thinking of somebody, the homeowner, who made the investment and relied upon this as a source of income and is thinking probably in the event of sale that this ability to continue to rent it out as a vacation rental with his license and all that adds some value to his property. So I'm not so sure I'm comfortable with sort of forcing it to be eliminated on sale. I'd hate to see somebody being deprived of that value that he planned on. Just a thought.
Other comments?
Yeah, we I was really curious because I, on this whole secondary rental and Airbnb and vacation rentals, and so I did a little short study on this and looked up on Airbnb to Morro Bay area to find out how many Airbnbs were available. And so you pull it up, and the headline number was 305. So I go, wow, that's really a lot. So drilled down a little bit, put a filter on there, and said, okay, well, basically, you know, if I want to rent it on a non-holiday weekend in summer, how many vacation rentals are available in Morro Bay? So by putting the filters on, it came down to like 173. So then I drilled down a little bit more and expanded the map of those. Most of them were outside Morro Bay. Mm-hmm. You know, they were scattered out, Los Osos, Atascadero, you know. So the number then dwindled down to something like 15 that were actual rentals available in Morro Bay on the weekend before the 4th of July. So then went in and individually looked at all these. Nine of them were in hotels. Mm-hmm. Were actual hotel rooms that were listed as Airbnb on the Airbnb site. And so when it actually came down to it, there were six viable units that were being rented on that summer weekend, which would be a prime weekend for rentals. So I was really concerned, and I expressed this, you know, in the first meeting, that we have 300 units that are being rented here, you know, under the radar. And then by actually filtering through, I personally found that, you know, this wasn't very scientific, but I personally found that this just isn't a problem at this point. So that's kind of what I concluded, but, you know, I wish everybody else to go through the same process.
Michael?
Well, I share Ms. Winholt's concern. I was also interested in what happens if we have a building permit issued for construction on something where one of these existed, because my concern is if someone did it under the old regulations, I don't mind grandfathering them to a point, but that income flow inflates the value of the house at a point of sale. And it's not that we're saying you can't rent it. You can't rent it for vacation rentals. So I would say that the person's value in having put the construction together is tempered in the way that the price would be adjusted so that it's not a vacation rental stream. It's a workforce rental stream. So I'm not concerned about that. If we grandfather it so that the person who's in it now can take this advantage when they choose to leave, I think that's a better point of concern. I also don't want to. It seems wrong to me to let people leverage that then for more construction. If they make major construction on the house, they should maybe lose that capacity as well. I'm just thinking, where are the points? You know, to me, when something comes up for more density, more construction, that's a point to examine it. When a point of sale comes up, that's a point to examine it as well.
The only thing I would say to that is we have three.
Yeah.
Pardon?
The only point I would make to that is we have three.
I think that right. this is a point of cultural transition. You know, I would say we have three legal ones, and you know, perhaps Commissioner Lewis filtering is one way to look at it. But my bet is in another few years we've got a lot more than this, and I think it's.
And if we did, and they're not currently permitted, then they wouldn't be able to continue them. If we found them.
That's
you don't get
saying.
To do it. I mean, it wouldn't be an issue. It would be an issue, I mean, up until the point we found it, at which point we would make them stop. And so, yeah.
There's other things besides Airbnb, too, that make the same arrangements.
So. There are clearly, and we're – so there's – we have a future agenda item with the city council to discuss this.
one of the things we're looking into is how do you go about, you know, finding there are a number of companies out there that have software that goes crawling through the internet and finds all of these types. Well, not all of them, probably never all of them, but can find many of them. And so we've been in contact with a couple of them and are looking into what that might look like, because there's a cost associated with that, but then there's us getting registered vacation rentals that aren't currently registered, and then there's money that comes into the city when we do that. So we are looking into, you know, some opportunity there, and then what the future discussion will look like on this. It'll be an agendized item before the city council coming up here, maybe this second meeting in May. I have to go back and look at the agenda, but it's coming up pretty quickly. So that is something that's on the radar.
I just know from talking to some of our Cal Poly graduates today about finding homes for their families to be in for graduation, that the usury rates are ridiculous right now for that small period of time. But I'm open to discussing termination of these. I think it's odd to take a category of things and extend it forever if we don't think it's right.
You know, there was a speaker that spoke on this, and he actually even, I think it was at a city council meeting, and quoted legislation. And if we go back to the baseline of why we allow a R1 lot to have more density and the affordable housing and the impact that I continually put in as far as to our infrastructure because of the short period of time and the impact from water usage and sewer flows and stuff. And like I've mentioned before, that like you go to Cayucas, one of my daughters lives in Cayucas, and literally a short block has like 7 vacation rentals and only like 2 permanent residents. So it is a potential issue, okay? Now, I too agree with Ms. Winholtz on this one. I think that we should, you know, it was, you know, you grandfather in something that, okay, you got away with it, you know, kind of thing. But you know, we should not, you know, not have that available for the sale as well. So I would like to see what you talked about there, but also at the end.
Well, you know, number one, I think we need to take this in context because the council also has directed a comprehensive look at the whole vacation rental issue, because the vast majority of vacation rentals are vacation homes. They're vacation houses that, you know, they're not secondary dwelling units. And in my opinion, there may be areas of town where using either vacation rentals or even second units for vacation rentals could be perfectly appropriate. That just needs to be defined. I mean, for example, downtown, you know what I'm saying? Or on the Embarcadero. There's, you know, this is part of something that's kind of ongoing. I'm very happy that the council changed their mind and came around to the correct way of thinking on this. However, you know, in terms of the grandfathering, I'm just taken by the fact that there's only 3 to maybe 5 in town. You know what I'm saying? And so. From 3 or 5 of these, the potential for public harm is pretty small, I think. On the other hand, there is a potential for, as Joe brought up, there is a potential for private harm. And to me, because it may reduce the value of the property. So, for me, it's not a big enough issue to change. There won't be any more after this. I mean, there's never going to be more than 3 to 5. So to me, and the illegal ones will never get legalized once this is passed. So to me, I guess to me it's just not worth changing it. I think it's fine the way it is. So, I mean, I don't think any of us are adamant about going one way or the other. Over somebody, three.
Somebody's got to make a motion. Or you need to talk more about it.
Please,
I don't know.
Please make a motion.
Yeah. Why don't we just do a little straw poll here? How many of us feel that it should that the current wording should be changed? That, you know, really needs to be changed. The grandfathering is there. No, the grandfathering is there for. Adding the expiration of the grandfathering on what was it? Change
upon
of residence
sale, upon
or
sale.
Major
yeah,
remodel.
Upon sale, yeah. Change of ownership. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to see that.
I don't think it's a big enough problem right now with only three units to justify the attorney expense, you know, or the staff time.
You don't have to worry about the attorney expense. He has to review it when it goes to council anyway.
Yeah.
It'll be a sentence.
But then the new language would have to come back to us and would have to be re-noticed.
No, it doesn't. You can make the ad and recommend it moving forward. That's what you're doing this evening. Okay. So, yes, the council directed to insert this change and have you review it. So we changed the language and brought it back to you, and you have all the authority you need to make changes to that language. And we will, you know, certainly forward your, you know, expressed desire.
In fact, we're not approving anything here, right? We're making a recommendation to council.
So
what they're going to make the decision one way or the other, regardless. Yeah. So we could certainly recommend that they consider the changes that have been suggested, and then that's all we can do anyway.
The one thing I'm concerned about is, even though it's a small number of units, is if somebody tries to do due diligence and they say, oh, Morro Bay protects the secondary units are, you know, long-term rentals, and then you move into one of these five and you get, you know, 12 college-age people from another university coming in there every weekend, because I thought they were going to be rentals for, you know, the laws basically say they're you know, market rate rentals for workforce housing, and it's not. We've got these five anomalies out there that someone isn't protected from what looks like should be the law. So it's one of these eccentricities that just carries forward in an odd way, like some of our odd constructions have. And I think that could potentially be a damaging thing to a neighbor to think they've got a situation next door, and it becomes an aggravation kind of thing.
Okay, and just to counter that, if that was a problem, if there was a continual complaint on a certain issue, wouldn't that complaint?
We have the ability to pull any vacation rental permit if people are abusing it. I mean, that's just the way it is. It's a business license, and it's written into the clause, so we have the ability to yank it at any point. Yeah. And so if it was on one of these, they just wouldn't be able to get it back. If you did it on a regular vacation rental over time, they could reapply later and potentially, you know, get the ability to have a vacation rental back. In this instance, they wouldn't be able to do that. Yeah. So,
Go ahead.
You know, I just don't see this as a big enough issue just because of the minuscule amount of the small numbers. That's all. As a theoretical issue, I agree with, you know, with Ms. Winholtz, and I agree that this is a theoretical problem, but as a practical problem, I don't see it.
Well, but again, couldn't we? Again, it's not up to us. Couldn't we simply say to the council, we identified two additional possible changes that you might wish to consider as you move forward with this ordinance? One would be sunsetting the business license upon change of ownership, and the second would be sunsetting the business license upon major reconstruction of the property. And we would like to submit those for your consideration, without saying you should adopt them or you shouldn't adopt them, because they're going to make that decision.
Okay. The The first part's great. That second part, the major reconstruction part, we don't have a definition of that, and I don't want to do that. if we want to change it to something else and make it an amount or an addition square footage or whatever, okay, so it's definitive. It's just the major reconstruction thing. We don't have a good definition of it. It's something we will resolve moving forward as part of general plan LCP zoning code update. But right now, that doesn't mean a whole lot in our code. And so I'd prefer that you not do that, if that's possible. I don't mind if you want to make it the addition, you know, or if you want to make it based on additional square footage or something. That's fantastic. That's straightforward. You know, you add 500 square feet to your house, then you lose it. I don't know. I mean, that's just a number. But at least that's definitive. People know what they can do and they can't do, and that's fine. The major reconstruction, they don't know.
It seems to me a logical point might be any increase in the size of the secondary unit. I can see if the guy had a 400 square foot unit and he was making lots of money, and he said, I could make twice as much money if I had an 800 square foot unit, that would be perhaps a good point to say.
Or if they're adding a guest house. Didn't we say something about?
They can, the ordinance as it's written allows you to have both. There are.
Mm-hmm.
But that wouldn't be grandfathered in.
On a larger lot in town.
Right,
I'm
right.
I'm talking about a grandfather condition, because it's not there.
So the point raised by Chair Tuft, the expansion of the secondary unit, that's pretty straightforward. You're either, you could remodel it to fix it back up in 20 years when it's not in great shape or whatever, and that's fine. You want to add 10 square feet to it, you're done. That's straightforward. You're going to do an addition, then you lose the ability to have it as a vacation rental and have to convert it.
Well, it would seem like if you're expanding the capacity to leverage your rental to make it a three-bedroom instead of a two-bedroom vacation rental,
right,
in what should be market house, market force rental.
So is that an agreeable breakpoint? Everybody? Okay, let's go with that.
So can we then have, the way I understand it, we would need a motion to adopt the resolution as presented and further recommendation to City Council to consider the changes that you've discussed regarding change of ownership or expansion of the secondary dwelling unit.
And that will allow it to just move forward with the council, right? It doesn't have to come back here again.
Correct.
Yay. All right. not that we don't like it, Whitney. It's a great ordinance. But
no, I could move on myself. Okay.
Okay. So do we have a motion to that effect to adopt the resolution with the additional recommendations as discussed?
I move we forward the recommendation for the grandfathering clause with the addition of the additional square footage and sales clauses.
And I think we have to put in adopt the resolution as well, right?
Yeah, that too.
Okay, adopt resolution, Planning Commission resolution 1416.
Wait, it's too hard to read that on my iPad.
Yes. It's fine. With a recommendation the council also consider the clauses that you discussed regarding ownership and size of the secondary dwelling unit, expansion of the secondary dwelling unit. Okay.
Do we have a second?
Yeah, I'll second that.
We have a motion and a second. Do we have any discussion on the motion? If not, I think we can do this by acclamation. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries 5-0.
I'll abstain.
Okay. Motion carries 4-0. Okay.
Thank you very much. And good night.
Pretty good discussion, guys. Okay, moving on to new business. Our first item of new business this evening is item number C1, which is a review and discussion of historic parking credits. And I believe that Joan is going to tell us about that since she gave us such a skimpy staff report. 300 pages here.
It is rather a skimpy staff report. There's just lots of exhibits. Thank you, Chairman Tuft, and good evening, Commissioners. The first item of new business this evening is an interpretation of the city's practice for honoring historic parking credits. General parking requirements are defined in the Morro Bay Municipal Code under Section 17.44.020 of the Zoning Ordinance. This code section reads that a change, expansion, or intensification of land use, which would increase the number of parking spaces, shall be based only upon the number of spaces required for the change or expansion. In addition, the city's 2007 parking management plan discusses the practice of grandfathering. The practice that the city has allowed for certain properties or uses that legally existed before the adoption of the zoning ordinance. The adopted parking management plan encourages this practice in order for the city to encourage revitalization of underutilized sites. Some examples of when this practice was employed on the Embarcadero include these locations listed on the screen. In each of these situations, whether through city correspondence, staff reports, or planning permits, consistent application of the grandfathering practice has enabled the lessees to proceed with their redevelopment proposals. On each of these sites, applicants were allowed to claim historic parking credits based on past uses and square footages, and sometimes even in cases where the building had been completely demolished and rebuilt. In some cases, historic parking credit was either not applied or determined to not be adequate for development proposals, and the applicant was required to pay in lieu fees. 501 Embarcadero had to pay for four spaces. 561 Embarcadero had to pay for three. It's unclear why in these locations there was no discussion in the record of historic parking credit, but we believe that probably due to the lack of a historic record and the lack of, discussion on historic parking credits, that was why we weren't able to grandfather those in. So they had to pay for in-lieu parking fees or provide on-site or off-site parking arrangements. So recently, the city has approved consent of landowner and request for proposals for three different lease sites on the Embarcadero, all with the understanding that the city would honor these historic parking credits at these locations. Therefore, it is staff's recommendation that the Planning Commission forward a recommendation to City Council that will memorialize the practice of using grandfathered parking for lease sites along the Embarcadero and direct that commercial parking requirements be addressed more holistically as part of the general plan, local coastal program, and zoning code update. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for staff?
I got one question for you, just for everybody else as well. Where do these in-lieu fees and how are they applied to the benefit of the city?
So we've allocated in-lieu fees for a number of improvements. Sometimes they're used for restriping projects. We've allocated some of the parking and leaf fees toward improvements in the Triangle parking lot at Dynegy. They've been used in other areas in the city. I top of my head, can't think of some other projects, but they typically get used for parking improvements, paving, parking lots, those types of things. And then the idea is that they're improving our existing parking situations that are out there or creating more parking spaces. Like we could have used parking funds or parking and lieu fees for, say, restriping of Market or something when we took the parallel parking right out here and made it perpendicular. I don't think that we actually used parking and lieu fees for that. I have to check with Mr. Livick about that. But those are things that you can use it for. Having only been here for 2 years, I don't have a long history of what we've been using those fees for, but. We do have a considerable amount of money in the fund.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't seem that there's any way to sort of trace what these parking credits really mean, other than, I guess, what a conclusion that currently there's adequate parking for all the commercial buildings on Embarcadero. That's basically what it means. And then going forward, we would have to decide, in fact, whether real additional parking accommodations have to be made.
Yeah, I mean, so part of this lends itself back to the discussion about economic development and how we allow, you know, properties in the city to redevelop. You know, it hinders them if you say you're applying our parking standards to properties on the Embarcadero or in the downtown. The Embarcadero, most of them don't have parking spaces associated with them. So they want to do an expansion. Well, then they'd have to provide parking for that, but they don't have the ability to park on site, nor do we want them to park on site. That area there should be utilized for things that are visitor serving. The parking we should be providing elsewhere. Example, you know, we recently purchased the D'Estasio site, acquired the parking lot that associated with it, and opened it up to the public, created 40-something parking spaces. We received recently, in the last couple of years, the Dynegy parking lot, and opened that up. It's about 150 parking spaces in there. So within the last couple of years, we've added 150 parking spaces that were not otherwise available down there. Those are the ways that you want to provide parking. And look at restriping options. We have the 2007 parking management plan that Joan mentioned. It does talk about some restriping opportunities that are out there. We are going to revisit some of those in town. We had a brief discussion with the council about that a little while ago. We need to do a little more work on that, though, to create some more parking, say, along Morro Bay Boulevard, and maybe on Main Street and things like that. But the idea is to create these parking spaces in public spaces or on publicly owned property, or to identify lease spaces that we could lease to create those parking spaces, those parking nodes, and then to have the ability for those businesses that are on the Embarcadero to expand and redevelop their lease sites without having to provide that parking, because we don't want ground floor parking in those things. That doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. Is that what you don't want to walk? You don't want to walk by a whole bunch of parking spaces down there. Just that's not what that area needs should be. I don't think most people think that. So I don't know if that totally answers your question, but
well, I think it does. But again, there's no real substance to these credits other than it says to the enterprise, you're okay with what you.
So it looks back at what uses were on the site previously and what the building uses were, and identifies parking related to that, and then says, hey, well, that previous use was X, and maybe it had three different uses in there, and maybe they had some docks, and they added up all the parking requirements that you would currently have if you put a new project there, and said, this is what your parking credit is. And the city's memorialized this over time for several of the lease sites down there. And you go back through history, you know, 10, 15 years, and you see the same parking credit numbers referenced in permit application after permit application and approval after approval down there. And so you have lease sites, some of the owners that have been involved with these lease sites for many, many years know that, because they've had projects that were approved, maybe didn't get built or what have you. And that parking credit, they've relied on that to bring their projects forward so they can get extensions on their leases. And if you don't allow them to do that, then it makes it very expensive for them to redevelop, and maybe makes it impossible for them to redevelop. So it's a bit of a tough nut to crack if you start saying you have to comply with our current parking standards. I don't think that situation is great. I think the parking credit thing is a little weird. I don't know that we have any other option in the city. You know, that horse sort of left the barn a long time ago. We've been doing this for a long time. And then to sort of dial it all back and say, no, you can't do it now, well, that's a little unfair to some of those folks that have been involved with those lease sites for many, many years. It's kind of like, you know, doing a 180 on them. So
is there any unfairness issue in some of the enterprises that don't have credits or don't have as many credits, and they're arguing, but my neighbor has 178 credits, and what does that mean?
Well, some of the lease sites maybe weren't developed in the past, you know, didn't have development on them. Maybe had docks or something, and that was it. So they don't have a whole lot of spaces. I think that's what you ran into with the examples that Joan showed on the screen, were like Gray's Inn and Estero Landing, Anderson Inn. So those ones where you're adding, you know, rooms and things like that that probably weren't there before and increased the parking demand, which was, as Joan said, intensification of use, that wasn't commensurate with the previous level of development that was there before. There's not a whole lot you can do with that. I mean, we're really just saying we have these calculations that are out there. They've been used repeatedly, and lease holders are relying on them to bring projects forward so they can extend their leases. And if we don't accept them
then they're not going to be able to redevelop their lease sites potentially, and it really is kind of changing the game on them because they've relied upon these in the past and received approvals for expansions and things in the past. But we wanted to bring it forward to you to see what your thoughts were on it, because it is a little bit weird to me. I mean, I'm you know, relatively new to the city, and so I see these things and I'm like, that's what we did. You look back and it's hard to figure out exactly how they were created, other than this sort of general discussion about it's based on the uses or buildings that were there before, and there's documentation of what those were and what the square footages were, oftentimes, and so that's where we get the numbers, and they persist over years and years and years. I do think we need to fix that. And moving forward, maybe as part of the update process that we're involved with the general plan and LCP and zoning code, fix it and say what we're doing with these and either allow them all to do it or say, nope, you're all paying in lieu fees or however you're doing it. This sort of nebulous grandfathered parking thing down there doesn't make you feel warm and fuzzy, I guess, is kind of the way I'd put that. And I think there's better ways to do it. And I think we're in a process now where we can start resolving it, which is why we have the two-pronged recommendation.
Well, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it's just exactly what you said. The older lease sites that had minimal development, like there was a boatyard down there, a sterile landing, I think is the one. Mm-hmm. It, you know, had no grandfather clauses, but then to redevelop it, they were at a disadvantage to something that had, you know, at one point, you know, just had bunk bed after bunk bed after bunk bed or something. So to take the parking credits away from the existing leaseholds that have them, I think is unfair. But to disadvantage the leasehold sites that didn't get them, when we want a certain development, a certain level of development out there, and they're required to have a certain level of development from their lease and the requirements of their leaseholds, I think is unfair also. So moving forward and taking a holistic approach, you know, possibly, you know, as a parking district in this area that allocates, you know, charges for parking and allocates those funds to take care of these parking credits and to establish parking and to extend parking and to, you know, in the future build more parking, multi-level, multi-story parking, I think is the way to go forward. Mm-hmm. But I don't see how we can take away grandfathered parking from the existing leasehold sites.
I want to agree with you like 1,000%, okay? To have on-site parking requirements written into the code for a pedestrian area like the Embarcadero is insane, okay? It's ridiculous. It inhibits development, okay, because people who don't have the parking credits can't afford to pay the in-lieu fees. The undeveloped properties cannot afford to bear the entire burden of providing new parking for the Embarcadero. You know, things have changed, okay? There's a lot more cars here than there were in 1965, okay? So, you know, there's also, you know, a lot more interest in alternative transportation, bicycling, and this sort of thing than there was back then. And so, you know, the whole idea that a business is required to provide parking is ridiculous. The other thing is, it does. If businesses do provide on-site parking, it's terrible parking. Okay, you have a bunch of little disjointed parking lots that nobody can find, and half the parking lot is taken up with entrances and exits because they're all so small. You end up with 10 times as many entrances and exits as you would have if you had just one big parking lot that people could actually find because it was sizable. So, you know, getting rid of this, I mean, there was some discussion at council a couple times ago about, you know, let's look at the ordinances that are impeding businesses in Morro Bay. This is number one, believe me. And so we have to get rid of grandfathering because we have to get rid of a situation where businesses have parking credits. You know, there's no reason why all of the businesses utilize the available parking to an extent. Okay, the buildings, it can be argued, the buildings which have the most intense uses, like a bar or a restaurant, actually use more of the available public parking than the other ones, and yet they get grandfathered, so they don't have to pay for any of it, okay? It's crazy. We need to get rid of grandfathering, but we need to get rid of... However, just for right now, grandfathering is the only way to let anything happen because the ordinance is so bad. If we don't grandfather, everything falls apart, you know, and so... We're in a situation where we're stuck with it. We have to keep doing it, even though it's unfair, even though it impedes development, but we have to keep doing it until we get the parking ordinance fixed, and it needs to be fixed desperately. The one thing that I would suggest, okay, we've got to get to a situation where the parking is planned and organized, and I realize you guys have kind of made great strides doing that with some of the new parking lots, even without a new program. Okay, and that's terrific, but that's exactly how it has to be done. Okay, not property by property by property. One of the things I would suggest we might recommend to the council also is that they put a hold on collecting in-lieu parking fees until we see what this program is going to look like. I think we go ahead and grandfather the request that you're asking for and sort of bless this whole process as a temporary measure. But I also don't think it's fair to charge the poor guy that's trying to develop a less intense lot an in-lieu fee right now, because there's probably going to be some program that's going to require all the businesses to contribute to it and maybe... You know, just let them work into that program rather than collect the $14,000 of space or whatever it is just before that goes into effect, you know. Sorry, I kind of shot my mouth.
Recommending this, it would be to suspend it down there probably at this point. But
Scott, if I'm looking from a practical standpoint, and One example that comes to my mind, and that this is going back in 94, I had a coffee shop over in Pismo, the Black Pearl. And I don't know if you were there yet, but you go on, what's that street, not Pomeroy, but the main drag there where...
You're going down Dolliver?
That was on Dolliver, yeah, but the main drag where they put the center, where Giuseppe's was, you know, and they
that's
had...
That's Price Street.
Price Street, that's Price Street. It. Okay. And then they created this parking scene there years later. From a practical standpoint, can you give me a little history? Was that, like, something that was in lieu of, you know... I'm just trying to look at it visually, how we can address this issue.
Interesting question. So, on Price Street... when I worked for the city of Pismo Beach, started back in 98-ish, you got off the freeway there going north, and it was like a racetrack till you got to the first stop sign. It was hard to cross the street. And we had a lot of restaurants over there, and so the concept became to try to create kind of a restaurant row type thing and to slow cars down. And to provide some additional parking for that area, because there were a lot of restaurants and all of the on curb parking would get taken up on the weekends, because you had Giuseppe's and Rose's and a sports bar, and I mean it was just a lot of things in that area that all the parking on the street ended up filling up. So we did it for the first couple of blocks there, and had it alternate sides, and it was very successful. We did it on a pilot program. And revisited it after a year. The folks that were on the other end of the block on Price, the next two that we didn't do it on, were like, where's our parking? And so we did it there too. And we actually made a couple of the streets one way, created a one-way couplet there to kind of improve circulation as well in the area. And
And that's where that came from. It wasn't, I don't know if we used in lieu fees to restripe the street or not. I don't recall. We could have. We had some in lieu fees in the hopper at the time. I just don't remember if that's what we did or it was, you know, taken out of the public works budget. I'm not sure which. But it was, again, it started as a pilot program and then became permanent. And there's not a, you know, business owner down there that I think that doesn't love it. And as a result, the occupancy rate there is about as close to 100% as you can get. Somebody moves out and there's a new tenant like that. So,
you know, when I look at, like, you gave all these examples on Embarcadero, I look at this in lieu fee similar to the, if I may make an analogy, similar to the eelgrass situation where you're dealing with that and you got this, you know, and you just happen to have a patch of eelgrass. It's kind of similar to that. And it's counterproductive on many levels. And so I agree with Dr. Taft in a lot of, on a lot of those reasons.
Yeah, I don't have much to contribute. It's kind of absurd to talk about a waterfront promenade and a, you know, walking downtown and continually inhibit it with parking spaces. And the it pressures the footprint and the profile of the buildings on the Embarcadero to get even larger because they have to pick up parking in certain areas. And so we take away some of the momentum to negatively affect the thing that should be the draw by not addressing these things more holistically like you're talking about. So, and I'm sure over time, you know, when you start to consider the large parking areas that we have, the shopping centers, the school that we're not using, all the stuff at the north and south end of the Embarcadero, there's so many pools of parking to tap to solve a lot of our problems. It's a much better city if we don't have to address everybody parking like a suburban lot.
Scott, is there any way that we could even, you know, accelerate this rather than wait for the local coastal plan update?
That'd be great, but we have so many initiatives going on right now that it really, that whole thing is a process, and it's a process that has to play it out, and it's planned, and it's scoped and budgeted, and it's in place. So I mean, it's a very large moving, you know, endeavor. It really is hard to change it. The zoning code piece, you know, where we would deal with the parking, and then, you know, is at the end, because you have to have your general plan and local coastal plan policies kind of in place. They will inform and talk about this a little bit. So as that moves forward, there'll be in circulation element, there'll probably be some discussion about parking in there, and then it'll probably be telling us to do some things that we're going to implement in our zoning code. And so it's a process, and you have to have one kind of telling the other one what to do. And we already have some disparate pieces that are moving at the same time, and I always spend a lot of my day keeping the consultants all looking at the same things and make sure we're going down, keep them within the lanes, I guess. It sounds great, and everybody recognizes, obviously, that we need to do something with it, but it really has to play out in the manner that we're doing it right now. It's too difficult to take the whole thing out and do it separately. I don't know how you would do it.
Could it be handled on a variance? Could this be a variance issue?
Well, I think Chair Tess' idea to add the other piece to that and maybe suspend the in lieu fee while we're going through this process, I think that's a really interesting thing to send to the city council to have them talk about. Because it eliminates the unfair piece for the sites that are sort of were undeveloped in the past and so don't get the benefit of those credits.
And we're talking about this on the Embarcadero, but this also plays into the downtown district also.
Yeah, very much so.
It does, and you can forward the recommendation related to both places if you'd like.
But the Embarcadero is most critical.
Well, we have some things that are moving forward right now, and we have timelines. So our consent of landowners, we've changed that process a little bit, and we give you deadlines when you have to submit and get through the process with us. And so those things are going to be coming at you pretty quick. And if I didn't have some input from you
and be able to move that input to the city council to sort of get confirmation about what we're doing. These folks are spending a lot of money developing plans, and if it was going to be a no-go, they need to know now, because what's the point? I mean, it's not fair to tell them to go and then tell them to stop, because that's basically what we would have been doing.
Well, but again, but on the other hand, the regulations that we have now apply citywide, you know what I'm saying? And so if we said this applies to the downtown core as well, and probably when this comes before the council for action, there should be a map, you know, for the Embarcadero area and the downtown mm-hmm. core. It might stimulate some redevelopment. It might get people thinking, oh, hey, I've been stuck here because of those stupid in-lieu fees. Now I can start to move forward with, you know, some plans. Mm-hmm. Because that's an area where intensification could occur. In other words, there's a lot of retail shops there that could become restaurants or, you know, something more intense. So I would say let's go with both areas.
Okay.
I see a scenario developing in the near future where the businesses on the Embarcadero are going to be asked to, they're going to be levied to contribute to building something that's more intelligent in the way of parking planning, whether it's a structure or lots. And in the same scenario, this fiction of the parking credits is going to be eliminated. It's a fiction. But I also foresee that some of the more lucky enterprises are going to feel like something was taken away from them if we memorialize these numbers of parking credits. It's purely a PR consideration, you know?
We're not going to be able to make everybody happy here. I think that's kind of the issue. I think there are folks that will have paid in lieu fees in the past and said, hey, that's not fair. Why do we have to pay? That could certainly be the case. But, I mean, the point is we're trying to resolve the issue and trying to solve it. I think when they were required to pay, that was what was in place, and that's what allowed them their development to move forward. At that point, they had to make a decision about that. The city, even to make it less painful, extended out the payment process. You didn't have to walk in and drop down your $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 that day to start. We actually had payment plans that were set up through our finance department to sort of cushion that blow a little bit. So the city did try to help a little bit. But you'll get some of those folks that have already had to pay and say, hey, well, I came early, so I got punished. But I think realistically the important thing is having the city take a look at this and resolve it, because it needs to be resolved. Continuing it in any form doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
There may be ways of softening that. Like you said, there's probably it doesn't take a crystal ball to see where this is probably going. It's probably going towards a parking district of some kind with an assessment, you know, and people that have paid in lieu fees could have a portion of that credited towards their payments based on how long ago it was that they paid mm-hmm. the fees. So there are, you know, kind of specific workarounds that could be put in.
And believe me, those conversations will come forward. I hear about this from some of the owners that have had to pay, so they've not forgotten about it. They don't like it. They're like, why did I have to? And they make the argument and complain about the way that some folks have credits and they didn't because they bought a site that was underutilized. I mean, so are they entered into a lease site that was underutilized and didn't get those same credits? So there are folks that will bring that argument forward, and at some point we'll have to in some meaningful way address it probably. I actually think that probably will happen.
So we don't need a I mean, you've got basically our discussion here.
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, you all seem to be kind of on the same page, which is great. I think everybody sort of recognizes we have a problem. And so, yeah, that's good. We'll add I think if you're all good with that, are you all good with the third idea, you know, that Chair Teff kind of came up with?
Yes.
Okay. And then being specific about moving this and applying it to the downtown area as well. Okay, got you all nodding. All right, thank you. Got direction.
Great. Okay, Our final new business item is review and discussion of the boat haul-out facility preliminary design plan. And we have no staff report on that?
I didn't give you a staff report because you asked me to give you the plans, so I gave you the plans. I'm very literal sometimes. So, I mean, you have these. These are hard to see, kind of up on the board there. These are kind of tough to see too. So, the city contracted with RRM to develop options for a boat haul-out facility, and it kind of looked at taking the parking lots that are over there off of the Front Street area and reconfiguring them and realigning them and realigning the parking over there to make it work better and to function with the boat, whatever you call that thing, haul out. I forget what they're called. Anyway, to provide the what?
Travel lift.
Thank you. and coming, and picking out a couple of different options for for how they would access the water from across the highway. And so you have all of these things in here. This is the more stylized version of it that kind of also shows the boat haul facility, the buildings, the boat storage on site. It also gives a location for the Maritime Museum. It's kind of those brown, the brown dot right there is Maritime Museum, potential location. This is where you'd be doing the offices and where the work on the boats would be done if it needed to be inside. And you see if I go back to the other one. So the first one has the haul route going out to the south of the T-pier. And then the other one has it and going through that parking lot. This one has a more straight route across the street, and then it has it going through the parking lot over to where you'd enter the water on the south side of the T-pier. So where this is at right now is the city council has seen the plan and sees that there was enough validity in it that this could potentially work, and so the harbor department has budgeted, I think in the upcoming budget for FY 2016-17, to look at the feasibility of doing a real feasibility study on what it would generate in the form of revenue, and how much it would cost to operate, and those types of things. And then now there's also been someone come forward that would be interested in doing this actually, and so they've had some preliminary conversations with them as well, and they've also looked at maybe some options for reconfiguration of what's even shown in the handouts that you have here on the board. So this is a little bit in flux, but the portion to study the financials of it to see if it really makes sense and really works is in the works and budgeted. So that effort will be moving forward. Questions? Comments?
Scott, I've got a bunch of questions. With the once-through cooling technique kind of by the courts being thrown out, I can't imagine we'd have a user that would use once-through cooling. Instead of taking out some of the docks that are developed and putting this down in that part of the waterfront, did people look at the potential of looking at the ocean or the bay intake area as a location?
The intake area, you mean for the Dynegy plant?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean that's owned by Dynegy. We don't have any access. We looked at the area to the north of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did.
Too shallow?
One of the real issues is getting over there and the amount of time the traveler spends on the road and then what we would do with that, do we limit times on busy weekends where you could only use the travel lift until, say, 10 a.m. in the morning or something, and then again later in the afternoon or what have you, so you'd have a time of a few hours in the middle of the day where you couldn't use it because traffic backs up on busy weekends pretty good down there. So that was one of the issues. The other is there's a lot of eelgrass over there.
And that became, that was also one of the issues. And so in the areas over here, there was less, I guess. And so that was one of the reasons why it was preferred. And the access points were pretty easy to align to make you come straight over there and get and go into the water there. So, and I think the floating docks that are in that location are in pretty bad shape and need to be rebuilt. So it was a good from a timing standpoint that those would be redone and moved a little bit to accommodate it. So that those were the conversations that were had at least while I was at RRM and they were going through some of these. Now, I wasn't at all of the Harbor Advisory Board meetings after that, but I did go to the initial sort of design charrette that we had on this thing at RRM, and those were the discussions that were coming out of the Harbor Advisory Board members. And so, and that was some of the conversation that went into the two proposed locations or the proposed designs and travel alignments that you see there. And they were trying to either, and they're trying to maintain and be able to put back, replace all of the parking spaces that would otherwise be displaced by the path of travel. So I think they did a pretty good job with that. I think we had ended up with a plus on the parking side of things.
I'm also, except for my kayak, a land lover. What's the travel speed of this device as it's moving around? Is this like the lunar rocket mover that?
They're pretty slow, which is why they wanted to limit the amount of time that it was actually on the road there. And so they were interested in having straight across, because if you do it, it takes a few minutes to get across the road. When you're, you know, if you have to get on it and then travel along the main road and then come back in, that's going to back up traffic and be a problem. And so that was going to probably place limitations on when it could be done. And I think the Harbor Advisory Board members were interested in maybe allowing it to be available as much as possible. So if you have a short trip across, then it's less of an impact. Certainly, those conversations for an approved project out there would have to be had more, you know, robustly, because even if you have a short section that you're crossing, it still might back up traffic too far back through the intersection back there, which would not be appropriate. And so that you may still have some limitations to when you can load and unload boats. So.
Yeah, my only concern was that moving across to the south seems the better thing relative to the traffic that would be wanting to park closer to the bay on the bay side. But then that that pattern of how fast that intersection queues up, you could be backed up down toward Giovanni's pretty fast there.
During busy weekends would not take long, and that is you know, one of the points of conversation that was brought up and how you deal with that, and so again, not something that was resolved out of this. This was really like, hey, is there a layout that works that we can get enough boats in here that it makes sense, and they can have enough boat storage in there that makes sense, and a place where they can work on the boats. Does that make sense? Can you fit the Maritime Museum in here somewhere? And so that's what these layouts are really to do. Like, okay, can we fit all the pieces on here? And is the result of the amount of storage capacity that they have, is that going to be economically feasible? So these seem to make sense, and you can maneuver in and out of here pretty well. And at least from the Harbor Advisory Board standpoint, they worked pretty well. And so they made a recommendation moving forward that they go to the next step, and that's do the feasibility study on it. So that's, I mean, that's literally where it's at now. And the only thing that really may, I don't know if it'll even change that, is that there's somebody that's actually interested in doing the project that's been at least recently talking with Eric Endersby, the harbor director. So I don't know a whole lot more about it than that. It was sort of a conversation had in passing earlier today, actually. So that's something that's sitting out there anyway.
And is there a third road being introduced? You've got the parking lot aisles, and then you've got the Embarcadero. But it looks like all the parking is facing the direction such that you're on the left side along the, you know, as if there's another road added alongside the Embarcadero, that all that parking's kind of counterintuitive the direction it's facing.
Well, it's because of the lane, the lane of travel, and you don't pull in forward. It's back in parking.
Oh.
Yeah. And so that's the concept behind that. So you.
Yeah. And why is that, Scott?
It was one of the solutions to be able to put parking in that location and to get a larger yield. And so that was the concept they brought forward. Because what was happening is, just keeping the parallel parking, we were going to be losing parking spaces. And overall, everybody sort of thought we probably shouldn't be losing parking spaces to do this. And so we were able to get a yield, I think, that, you know, just slightly exceeded what was there before by doing parking in that manner. It also creates what our city engineer likes to call visual friction when you have the cars parked there. So cars will slow down when they're driving along the road there, which is probably a good thing. Cars can tend to drive fairly, when there's not a lot of traffic, they kind of move down there a little bit, maybe faster than they should. So if you put that there, they'll drive slower. So anyway, interesting concept, and that's why and where that came from and what that is, I guess.
So how big a vessel is it? Can it use? Can it lift? Can it move out?
Top of my head, I don't recall. They were looking at a couple of different size travel lifts, and I just don't remember off the top of my head which one. Like, they had three of them laid out when we were doing the charrette thing, and I don't remember which one they were going with and what the capacity was of them.
They're trying to, from my information, I don't have all the information, but they're trying to make it so that it's large enough that it'll handle a standard, you know, fishing boat or trawler that would be using this harbor. So you're talking about a 100 ton, 75 ton, 125 ton travel lift,
that sounds very familiar. That's the rating that they were talking about.
Yeah, and they're talking. So it's a fair size.
Is that bigger or smaller than the one in Avila, Port St. Louis? Do you know?
It would be a little bit bigger.
Wow.
But not by much. It's comparable. And so.
Did they give? I know nothing about this. Did they give any thought to laying out a detour or a siding so like you could kind of move the boat into an island and reroute the traffic around it while it was now crossing the island?
I don't know that any thought that was given to that. That does not sound like something I recall them talking about now.
It really isn't that big of a problem. I've got some familiarity with this, to cross that street from one, you know, you'll be going, you know, the northbound lane and the southbound lane won't be blocked pretty much at the same time. So to cross one lane and then the other lane, you're talking maybe 2 minutes. So, you know, we're not talking about watching a 200 car train go by,
right.
You know, but it's a walking pace. They move at a walking pace. So somebody isn't going to get run down by one of these, you know, unless they're asleep. But you're also not going to really, you're not going to impede traffic that long. And most of the people that would see a boat coming across would be pretty interested in it anyway.
Yeah. Do they typically, is there typically somebody that like goes ahead to kind of warn traffic?
Yeah.
Because I don't imagine they stop on a dime either.
No.
And they talked about having a system that where you have warnings of some type and it's a crossing type situation. They had different ideas, and so there was a lot of those that were flying around. What they eventually came up with, I don't know, but they were looking at something along those lines. And it wouldn't be just necessarily the travel lift. They have those like hand cart things that they'd be using to get them over to the dock that's sitting out there, so you could have other smaller size boats that are stored there, you know, lifting and put in the water. They talked about those as well.
Were they planning on a smaller derrick also for skiffs, you know, instead of just a
couple of the folks talked about that. I don't know if it would probably depend on the operator and how they do it. I mean, there was discussion of other, not just that large travel lift being the thing that takes everything over there, but with smaller boats, and since they have the storage there, they have the ability to have sort of those hand cart type things that you could take them over there with, and so that was going to be one of the things they talked about. So, anyway.
Hey, Scott. Obviously, they're looking at Measure D and you know, I guess the museum and all that stuff falls into that place, so I'm assuming that is okay. And then the buildings, One of the things that I have a friend that is involved there, and the ice machine, which is right in that general area, one of the things that...
It's next to... That's actually next to Fowler's lease site.
Okay, but it's in like generally there. And one of the things that was a concern, like for fishing, is you could pick up fuel and pick up ice in the same spot. Right now, the fuel is on the other side, right?
Yep.
I know that, you know, not to have underground tanks or above ground tanks maybe is an issue, but, you know, you could also have like we schedule Tuesday or Wednesday's fuel up day where you can have a temporary truck come in and have a storage facility. Have they talked in any length on that?
No. So interesting, talking about Fowler. His lease site and the improvements originally included a fueling station that was potentially going to be there, but it was removed.
Okay. But even a temporary one wouldn't be considered, huh?
Yeah. I mean, it's just not something that's, you know, I mean, you have to have one of the folks that has a lease site out there that's willing to do it and wanting to operate it. Again, that lease site is part of the previous approvals. Mm-hmm. The Fowler one had it included and then it was removed later because he didn't want to do it. Wasn't interested in it.
And then the other question is this area zoned like what, heavy commercial? Is that what it is? Or heavy industrial?
It's got an industrial, designation on it. Like the remainder of the the Dynegy plant does.
Yeah, so because, you know, it was one of the kind of a weird thing that I was looking at different areas as far as by the wastewater treatment plant. I realized, and correct me if I'm wrong, but that the Hansen's concrete plant was zoned light industrial. You know,
it's next to visitor serving commercial.
Okay,
so if you're mixing uses that don't go together. There you go.
So that's just like one of the things. That's one of the reasons. It's like to look, you know, for us. So when we're looking at general plan and updates and stuff like that, when these things, I appreciate you throwing some maps in here, so we get a little visual of what direction they're going.
So Scott did your question get answered?
Yeah.
Okay. Have they looked at, tidal flow velocities in this area? Do you have any idea?
You're getting kind of beyond my, I was engaged, you know, at the planning kind of level with all of this. They were showing layouts and what it looked like and what we were accommodating and were they being realistic about things we could achieve and making sure that they were paying attention to the interactions with the adjacent parking lot, the parking widths, making sure we weren't impacting the other businesses that were further down that parking lot. Those were the things I was concerned about. And then how we were interacting with the travel lanes on the road and where we were coming across, and what that looked like, because from a delay standpoint, that was a concern of mine because, again, busy times, that could be a problem. And so those were the things I was kind of looking at. I have to admit that I'm learning a lot about harbors and, more than I ever knew before, harbors and boats and things like that. I mean, it's a good process, and it's really interesting to me. It's just my overall knowledge of it is not real high. It's getting better, though.
There's the reason I asked that question is this will be a cross-current slip. So, in high tidal flows, in certain areas of the bay, this can be 3, 4, 5 knots, especially if there's velocities, increase in certain areas. But if they pick the wrong spot for that, then it'll only be able to be used at slack tides. So that's, only 4 times during the day, mm-hmm. For a short amount of time. So that's something that should be considered on this. I think it's a fabulous plan. And I could use it tomorrow.
One question I would have is, have they gone over this? My recollection is, because this has been talked about for a while, mm-hmm. but my recollection was that the boat storage was sort of necessary economically to help support the lift out.
That's correct. And there's kind of a, at least folks on the HAB that are familiar with this. There's a certain sort of minimum size that you can have a number of boats you have to have kind of available to make it even like feasible or remotely feasible. So you're correct. That's exactly one of the funding mechanisms that goes into it, you know, how you can generate enough revenue, one of the revenue generating options that go into it to make it viable, because of the size, it's small. The site's small, and so it right. makes it, it's going to make it difficult. And so the more of the storage opportunities you have on site, the better it makes it for.
Well, that's what I was asking. Is this going to be an adequate size piece of property to pull it off?
My guess would be if we were able to take down the Dynegy plant and put something else over there, moving this someplace else on that site would probably be much better. So if that comes forward anytime in the near future, then that would be something that maybe it could go in a location like that, because here's tight. It takes you to a parking lot that's for really commercial uses, mm-hmm. Two of them actually. And so, you know, certainly not completely ideal, although, you know, with some restaurant things over there, people like to watch it. I mean, if you go to Santa right. Barbara, you sit there in your restaurant and watch the travel lift going back and forth with boats. I mean, it doesn't get a whole lot more interesting than that. I don't know when you're sitting there. So it is a draw from that standpoint. I just think you got, I mean, going through all of these kind of heavily populated parking areas, I got to think is probably not the ideal thing, and you'd rather go through fewer of them to get over to the water. So.
And then I guess the other issue, has there been any discussion about the visual of it? Is it going to be screened? Is it going to be sort of out in the open?
So we did talk a little bit about that, and the location of and why you have the Maritime Museum building out there in front, and then they're sort of the location for their temporary building where the pad is out there, that 400 square foot one, which is going to be the kind of their interim facility until they're able to fund the other pieces, to have that out in front. So you are screening that, you know, you are screening looking back at the facility. So it's not, you know, you're not looking at closely at all the industrial stuff that's there. I mean, you'll still see it. And then
the boatyard comes all the way down to the Embarcadero in one spot.
It does. And so you'd be looking at landscaping and things like that in that area to screen it. And so those are the conversations that were had as part of the sort of design shred things they were doing.
You also have, if you go down to Avila, or if you go down to Ventura, or San Diego, or, you know, Kettenberg, or any of those places, there's people, there's a large majority of people that wander through the boatyard. Hmm. I mean, this is, you know, it's fascinating for people, you know, for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, I actually think, you know, that this actually creates the working harbor appearance of Morro Bay. And we've been tending towards T-shirt shops and tattoo parlors. This is, you know, this is more the fishing village, you know, that we're trying to portray on the billboards. But,
yeah. Scott, I was this future maritime museum. Am I correct? This is a three-story building?
No, we don't allow three-story.
Yeah, but that's,
we'd be able to have three-story in that location.
Okay.
Literally, it's a placeholder. I mean, it's a box on the map because we don't know what it's going to look like.
Okay.
They were just. So we needed to fit, because this is city-controlled property, right? We needed to fit all of the uses that we've been talking about putting there. So it's the haul-out facility, some boat storage, and then we've been talking about the Maritime Museum for a while. And so where could a building approximately the size that they're looking to put there go? Where do the other ancillary boats that are associated with the museum go? And so it was a little bit of a puzzle piece exercise when they were laying them all out on there to make sure they fit. So it's, you know, it's schematic, you know, at best, really, for that standpoint.
How close are we to that Maritime Museum happening?
I don't know. I mean, I know that they were, you know, we went forward and kind of relocated the area where the boats associated with it go. We ported the pad and changed the access entry to the parking lot to accommodate the sort of interim facility they're going to have, this 400 square feet. And they talked about making it off-grid, so it's going to have solar, and it'd be kind of cool. I mean, it was small, 400 square feet, so like the size of a garage. And, you know, they were talking about the potential that they might have, you know, funding over the next couple of years to put that in. So, but I haven't heard anything more recent than that on it. And that was a few months ago. So I don't know if that's changed or not. Okay.
So any other comments or questions on the fallout facility? Except that we're in favor of it, I think. Okay, we have no unfinished business tonight. Any comments, future items for the Planning Commission?
I would just like to say that I think it was on the Tribune, the cover of the Tribune, the Congresswoman Capps had a meeting at PISMO in support of the Chumash Heritage National Marine Sanctuary. So a lot of excitement on that issue for a lot of people.
Scott, I mean, I need your help. I was talking to you the other day, and I said there was something I was going to bring up during this. And it's completely out of my head for future consideration.
What were we talking about?
Oh, man.
I remember you doing it, too. I remember you walking out and saying that.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
I guess.
Stop laughing back there.
For those of you on TV, the crew is just cracking up. I guess it'll come back one of these days. One of us will get it.
Yeah,
back,
probably
right?
When I'm driving home.
Okay. So, any comments from you, Scott?
I do have one. We do have an upcoming workshop in this building. It'll be on May 25th, and it'll be from 6:30 to 8:30. And it'll be to review, it'll be a workshop for the Centennial Stair and Embarcadero Widening Project. And we're going to be doing some mailers and outreach to businesses along the Embarcadero and in the probably western part of the downtown to get some of those notices out there. We'll do some posts on Facebook and some outreach along those lines to sort of get folks to come to the meeting. It's going to be for the discussion of the potential to widen the Embarcadero sidewalk. In some areas, you're probably aware it's 4.5-5 feet wide. You can't walk 2 abreast down there. Just walk into the street oftentimes on busy weekends. Not great. So we're looking to resolve that. RRM, again, is helping us out with that endeavor. And then we're also looking at the redo of the Centennial Stair and what that could look like, and have another, what, you know, maybe there's a, we talked about a funicular going up there or some elevator or something else along there along with the stairs, and redoing that whole area, maybe getting rid of that little funky street piece that's in between the chessboard and the bathroom, and making that more of a plaza and gathering area. Potentially even looking at options for making the Embarcadero one way, putting a two-way bike lane in. We now have the bridge coming over here, and now folks will come along over the bridge and come into the Embarcadero area, but you get all the cars down there and there's not a separated bike path, and so they'll end up like parking their bikes and, you know, locking them to the fence or whatever over there so they can walk in, because it's kind of scary with the family, if it's a family coming down here or whatnot. So extending bike lanes down into the downtown would be great, separated, two-way type things. And so they're going to be looking at some of those options and allowing, some interaction with what people think about that. It should be an interesting workshop to see what people think. Certainly improvements for making the experience down the Embarcadero, and then how we connect to get up to the downtown, because the next endeavor is the downtown waterfront strategic plan to really connect the two and to brand those things and to tell us what those look like, design guidelines for those areas. So we have some planning efforts that are coming along to do all those things, and this is sort of the initial phase for that. So kind of excited about that. And again, that's on May 25th in the Vets Hall from 6:30 to 8:30.
Excellent. Okay. If there's no other business then, we will adjourn to our next regular meeting here at the Veterans Hall on May 17th at 6 o'clock. Thank you.